This is the State, Alaska State Senate Resources Committee. Today's date is March 10th, 2010. The time is 3:35. We have with us Senators Wagner, French, Wilkowski, and we'll have more coming. Today, we're taking up an overview of the ACES Energy Regulations. It's a long-awaited. I know you've been working on this for a long time. And just looking at it, my guess is they're pretty meaty. We have it listed again for tomorrow. We're probably not going to get through this today, so we'll so you're aware and the viewers out there are aware as well, and committee members. This is something that's very important. We're open for public comment right now, and I'm sure we get political comments as well.
It's what we do, Mr.
And with that, I'd like to welcome Pat and Marcia to the committee, and please put yourself on the record and tell us what you're doing. Tell us what you've been working on for the last couple of years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, Commissioner of Department of Revenue, and to my left is
Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue.
Thank you. And today we're going to walk you through actually what amounts to two different regulation packages that were put out by the Department of Revenue over the course of the last month and are currently out for public comment. They deal with the interrelationship between the ACES production tax law and the AGEA open season. With the open season coming, we recognize that the AGEA tax inducement provides an opportunity to a company that would commit to acquire capacity at that open season to obtain a tax exemption. And the tax exemption is for basically the difference between the taxes that are at the time that they're producing and the taxes that are in effect at the commencement of the open season. And so the first part of what we're going to discuss with you today is going to be what we're referring to as the ACES regulations dealing with how gas is priced for tax purposes. So how you determine the destination value of the gas for production tax purposes, and how we derive the deduction for transportation costs to get to a point of production value.
I just pause right there to welcome Senator Stedman.
And then in addition to, so those are what needed to be in effect at the commencement of the open season in order to ensure that the tax system was as comprehensive as possible for gas going into that open season. And then in addition, there is a package of regulations dealing with the tax inducement itself. And so you have a section dealing with how you qualify for that inducement and then what it actually means, how you would use and determine what that exemption is. And we'll walk through how that is calculated and how it's determined under the regulations. So we're going to start by looking at the regulations dealing with the valuation and transportation deductions for gas. And these are very complex. I'll just warn you right at the outset, because of the nature of the natural gas markets that we'll be dealing with. Our sister agency, Department of Natural Resources, has a similar task for their royalty purposes to determine a valuation methodology. And under the AGEA inducement associated with royalty, they actually are offering a valuation methodology in the as part of the upstream inducement that is intended to provide more certainty and predictability for the producer in being able to anticipate what their gas valuation may be. What we tried to do with our tax valuation regulations is to mirror as much as possible the DNR methodology so that it provides a a more unified system for both purposes from a taxpayer slash taxpayer perspective. They don't have to deal with two different accounting methodologies or potential systems. It makes the implementation a little bit easier because we can utilize each other's information. And from the standpoint of putting the regulations together, we were able to basically work off of each other's thoughts in terms of how to deal with some of the complexities that we're going to show for you. I know that the Department of Natural Resources will be here next week to talk about their regulation package. And in fact, one of our primary consultants that has worked with us on these regulations from Black and Veatch will be here with them. And what I suggest is just a way of thinking about the sequence of presentations is today we're going to try to provide you with an introduction and a broad overview of some of the concepts that we dealt with, how we generally dealt with them from a structural standpoint, and how we approached some resolution of those, and that you kind of save for next week once you've had a chance to digest that and kind of put that into context, maybe some of the detailed discussion for when you've got Fred here from Black and Veatch and can kind of get into some of the inner workings of the gas market. But we're happy to talk about that. I think Fred's on the phone now if necessary.
Let me just pause to recognize that Senator Stevens has joined us. And we do have Fred Hagemeyer, and John Larson on the line as well. Right. Any members have questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Just a procedural question. Did you have a quorum to start? We started with
no, we didn't. We don't, we're not conducting any business.
So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Davis to walk you through the ACES regulations and provide you with that broad overview of how we do the valuation and the transportation deductions.
Thank you. This is, again, Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And we do have on the phone an individual, Fred Hagemeyer with Black and Veatch, who will be presenting part of the slides that you'll be seeing today, as well as John Larson, who's one of our audit masters, who was one of his key responsibilities was helping to develop the regulations as well. What I'd like to start with is just a discussion of the overarching principles that guided our regulatory process. The first was, obviously, our duty to ensure full value is received by the state through its production tax laws from the natural gas production. So that was one of our overarching principles. In addition, certainly we've heard a lot of, there have been a lot of lessons learned from having been in the position of having oil marketed, valued for tax and royalty purposes, having a lot of issues arising out of that, every kind of permutation on disputes that can happen regarding what is the proper way to value oil, prevailing value, reasonable value, marketing, was something arm's length, was it not, et cetera, has been brought to bear in how we've approached the gas. We don't want to make the same mistakes twice, and we want to provide as much clarity as possible to industry. So for several reasons, as we approached this, it was a new day, and we thought, let's get the gas stuff right. And so we met with our DNR brethren and looked at the things they were going to have to do relative to valuing gas for royalty purposes. And we looked at what we were doing for tax purposes. And we tried to the best of our abilities to come up with a common approach so that industry didn't have to bang its head on the wall saying, well, wait a minute, if this is the value of my gas for tax purposes, why can't you accept it as the value for royalty purposes? What gives? Why do I have two different systems here? So we really have worked hard to try to make as consistent where it's legally permissible, because obviously we each have our own respective statutory authorities, and we can only do that which we are authorized by statute to do. So we worked hard doing that. We We benefited from having a common consultant between us who could understand and grasp our concepts and understand when things needed to be different, when they needed to be the same. So we were able to hopefully pick the best solution between ourselves to a particular problem. The other thing that we had to struggle with as DOR is we have certainly a body of case law, and we certainly have a body of regulations that have approached how you value things and principles of how you value things for over 25, 30 years. So what we're doing here needs to be consistent, harmonized with our past practices as well. However, as Commissioner Galvin has indicated, the natural gas industry, what we've learned is has a lot of unique differences in the way gas gets sold, in the way it gets marketed, its fungibility, how it moves across the nation, and the system that's in place for handling gas, and the types of processing that happens of gas. Oil, pretty much, you know, once it leaves Alaska, it goes and hits the West Coast, and we're kind of done with it. We don't pay much attention to the downstream manufacturing into plastics and, you know, asphalt and different things like that. I mean, we pretty much are able to not get too involved in those issues. But for gas, gas is tends to be marketed more in its constituent parts as well, so that we have to deal with the pieces of gas. Things get marketed. People pull stuff out and send it on down. We've had a little bit of experience with that with the oil, but not as much as is going to happen with gas. So we needed to go to school on that, and we got a lot of education. The other thing is, one thing we do know is that whatever regulations we set up for marketing, for handling what the price of gas is and how it's going to be transported, we want to make sure that we're flexible, because we've learned that from the oil regime. What you think is always going to be a price marker that'll always be there forever may not be. And so what we're trying to do is build in the flexibility so that people don't have to keep coming back and seeing new regs or changes in how we're doing things. We want there to be some certainty about how we will step our way through our decision tree when and if this particular benchmark is no longer available. It's very clear what our next option will be. So hopefully at the end of the day, we will, through our process, minimize litigation on valuation, minimize litigation on how we calculate tax, the transportation costs. And our goal is to make this as streamlined as possible for the burden on the DOR as well as on taxpayers. One of the things that we have recognized from dealing with the valuation of oil and the oil transportation issues is the availability of information. Within Alaska, we deal with TAPS. You would think that based on the fact that you've got an oil transport system located within the state of Alaska, there shouldn't be much difficulty in acquiring the information we need relative to what is the cost of transportation. I thought that at one time as well. I have learned otherwise as we have struggled with developing over the last year and a half. What we started off with was our oil transportation regulations. And we thought, well, we'll just simply ask the producers to tell us, you know, what the cost components are of the, you know, transportation system. Well, guess what? There's this, you know, is it Elkin's Law, you know, that basically says that the shipper, the pipeline company can't share information with the shipper if they've got their own subsidiary shipping as well. They don't want to show favoritism. So there's an appalling lack of information flow between a pipeline company and the people who ship on that line. But it's the shippers who have to pay the tax. So we have been struggling with how to obtain publicly available information that relates to the cost of shipping that a taxpayer can access and use readily in calculating their tax bill. So what we've devolved to doing is looking for what gets reported on their FERC reports, or, you know, the other reports have to be filed from the prior year, and recognize that it's last year's data that will be applied to the current year. But frankly, that's the closest we can come to getting data that's available. So that's one element that we learned about that was a challenge. And that's just in Alaska, where theoretically the Department of Revenue has subpoena power and could go in and acquire these records, but then we can't divulge them to the taxpayers. So we'd have to sort of post them as an aggregate. And again, we struggled with a lot of ways to try to get information available that was clean and streamlined. So when we look at gas, our eyes just rolled to the back of our heads, because when you think about gas transportation costs, now we're talking about dominantly transportation that occurs in Canada in the lower 48. You're beyond the subpoena power of the Department of Revenue when you get to that stage, and certainly beyond the perhaps the ability of taxpayers to acquire information, because some of these transportation systems are unregulated. Gas does not have the same degree of its regulatory oversight is a little different than TAPS is with FERC. So, for instance, in TAPS, you almost always end up with an adjudicated just and reasonable rate. With FERC and gas lines, you'll tend to get approved rates that have a little less scrubbing and hammering and looking under the edges and turning over the rocks. So one of our concerns as we drafted the transportation regulations in terms of how to come up with what are the costs that can be deductible was to come up with a system that would ensure that our taxpayers could have the information necessary to make the deductions. Finally, gas is unique in that because of the system we've set up under AGEA, that gas that gets transmitted via the commitment at the initial open season versus subsequent open seasons has benefits or non-benefits. You also have gas coming out of Cook Inlet versus gas coming out of the North Slope. There'll be gas that comes out of Canada that joins up with a line that flows on down into Chicago. You've got a lot of commingled streams that are going to be coming in. And what we wanted to ensure was that, one, neither the state nor the shippers gamed the system, so that from a state's perspective, we didn't want to say, oh, well, some of that gas made it into the highest price market at the lowest cost transportation, so we're going to cherry pick and say that was the gas that came out of Alaska. Well, that wouldn't be fair to a taxpayer. Likewise, we wouldn't want a taxpayer to do the reverse. Pick the lowest price gas with the highest cost transportation, say, oh, hey, Alaska, hate to tell you, but that was your gas that got marketed. So what we've done is develop a system where when it gets commingled, we do a proration that equitably sort of allocates the pluses and the minuses of market pricing and transportation costs evenly across the board.
We recognize Co-Chair McGuire has joined us.
And finally, the last overarching principle is where we could, and this actually was presaged by this legislative body when ACES was passed, there was a direction from the legislature that we try to look to rates that have been set by FERC and honor those as a prima facie evidence of what was a reasonable cost to deduct. And so we tried to continue that principle into our gas transportation regulation structures as well. So with that said, I'd like to just sort of start with the overall statutory framework, and this is sort of the basics without all the legal fancy words in it. Essentially, when you're a taxpayer producer, in order for you to calculate your tax, you first have to figure out what the value of your gas is at the point of production, and that is at the entry point to the pipeline after gas processing, after, you know, it's coming off the field.
We pause to welcome Senator Huggins.
And what that says is your value at that place, which for us is, well, let's just think of it as someplace up on the North Slope before it gets put into the gas treatment plant and the pipeline.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator French.
You know, I was just about to ask you a question, and I think you actually might have just said it different ways, so I just want to make sure I'm perfectly clear. The point of production for gas is where?
The point of production for gas is downstream of gas processing, upstream before you put it into a gas treatment plant.
Okay, that's right.
That's the cutting point, dividing
some,
point.
Some flange, we'll have a little marker there, and we'll all say that's the point of production.
Right.
Upstream of the multi-billion dollar
gas treatment plant. And I say assuming there's gas processing, because essentially on the slope there is gas processing, because they're CGF, basically are pulling the CGF, they're pulling NGLs out, and they're pulling stuff out that they might want to use and re-inject. And essentially what you would leave in that gas stream is everything else that you want to put into a gas line to market somewhere else. And the gas treatment plant, its purpose is to make sure that that gas is in a condition that it's safe to transport it, so it doesn't have any water to erode the pipeline. It doesn't have CO2 or things that would be problematic for the pumps or anything else. So it's basically gas treatment is just intended to prepare it for its journey in transport.
Mark, thank you. Let me just pause you for a second, and we've got a full committee now, and we just so the committee knows, we've been trying to set up this hearing for several weeks, and the regs just came out, and maybe you can sort of give us just a quick overview of when the regs came out and what the timeline is for the public that, watching at home, to comment on the regs.
This set of regulations that I'm talking about right now, which would be the transportation cost deductions and how you value the gas for purposes of calculating what tax you owe, those were released approximately 2 weeks ago, and there's a 30-day comment period. We had, I shouldn't say 2 weeks ago, it was earlier than that. The written comments are due March 15th, so it would have been 30 days before that, so probably the middle of February.
So if the public at home wants to comment, they need to send written comments by March 15th?
That's correct, to the Department of Revenue, and we have it posted on our website, and it's to the attention of John Larson. So this
DNR
set...
The DNR regs are due when?
DNR regs...
They come out the same time as our second batch.
Yeah, the second batch was approximately a week later. So those would be probably the written comments would be due approximately March 22nd, 23rd, in that time frame. So I'm a taxpayer, and in order for me to pay my taxes, I take what I got from my gas, or if the state tells me a prevailing value associated with the value of my gas, and I subtract the cost, the actual cost, or if the state, if the rules so indicate I can't use my actual cost, I have to use my reasonable cost, I deduct that, and I end up with the value, the gross value at the point of production. And so there's where we sit on the pivot point of deciding two things. One, does a taxpayer get to use its actual sales price, or does it have to use what's called a prevailing sales price? And the statutory direction to the department is we require the use of a prevailing sales price. In other words, we're not going to let you use your real one, but you're going to have to use one that would be considered the market price, or the one that, you know, is out there that other people generally, you know, get as a sales price for their gas. When that transaction is not arm's length, or whether when we look at it, it's suspiciously below market price. So, and I say suspiciously, frankly, it's if it's below, then we deem it to be not good enough, and it has to be the prevailing price. And that's what our statutes tell us.
Can I just pause you right there? So that seems to give a huge amount of leeway, actual price versus prevailing price.
Mm-hmm.
Are you giving the producers the leeway to figure out how do the regs deal with that situation?
The regs go into it, and basically we define what is considered arm's length by essentially looking at what the transaction was, who was the seller and who was the buyer, and if there's a relationship between those two such that we would define them as being affiliates or the same entity. And an affiliate, we've basically utilized the definition, if you have more than a 10% or more voting interest in who you sold to, then you're deemed to be a related party. It's not arm's length.
Senator French, do you have a question?
I answered it. Thank you.
Okay. Then that tells me what price to use, put on my gross price number.
Can I just, because I just want to clarify. I know Marcia mentioned this, but I just want to repeat it. It's the higher of. It's between the prevailing value and the arm's length value. The state will use the higher of those two to calculate the production tax.
Right. Then with respect to the...
Can I just pause you real quick? When you say prevailing price, is that a Henry Hub price? Is that a production basin price? Or where do you gather?
Nope. Well, we have several... We have slides to show
you. That's what we're talking about here.
It's not easy. I'm going to get right to that and tell you what your choices are for selecting a prevailing value. And that's why we had to write a bunch of regs, because it's not easy to figure out. Okay, so transportation depends, again, on if you ship on a transportation facility, and the transportation, recall, includes the gas treatment plant and the pipeline and anything, you know, if you're downstream and you're processing. And the vessels, you know, includes ships too. if it's arm's length, or a not, if it's not arm's length, or if it's with an affiliate, then we're going to do a reasonable cost of transportation. We're going to figure that out for you and tell you what it should be. So this is what happens to you as a taxpayer. You've got to pass through both of these questions, and that's what our regs are for. So first of all, gas valuation. When gas is delivered off the North Slope, we base the value on the higher of, and this is what Commissioner Gavin was saying, the weighted average sales price of what we'll call the third party, the unassailable sale prices in the market, or the prevailing value, and that's set by statute. The prevailing value, you'll note we say at destination markets. You're beginning to get a hint where we're going with how we're going to define prevailing value for gas. And recall that gas product that we're going to be having to come up with a value for, you might sell your gas off the North Slope just untouched, just ship it all out there. I don't want to strip out a bunch of stuff. Just put the raw gas down there, and I'll sell it someplace and get a price for it and let somebody else have the headache of pulling stuff out.
So Marcia, weighted average sales price, if you sell one BCF at $6 an MCF and then three BCF at $7 an MCF,
you weight that.
You okay.
Yeah, you come up and with an average price per you know, 1,000 cubic feet of water.
Arm's length transaction, you define that in regulations as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You may sell your gas as stripped out, so all that's left is residue. And just so you know, residue gas is, if you were to take Prudhoe gas and strip virtually everything out but the methane, that's what we consider to be the residue gas generally. Gas plant products are the things you strip out. So that would be your ethane, your propane, your butane, your NGLs, all these other things that reside, you know, sort of collectively with the gas. But frankly, residue gas has a value because utilities, that's what they burn. They value methane. In fact, the more pure methane you give them, the happier they are. And then finally, LNG, because some people sell LNG. They go through the extra process of freezing it and doing it and being able to sell it. So we've got four different kinds of products, and within gas plant products, we've got a whole range of products there we're going to have to keep track of to come up with a value if that's what somebody's selling. So assuming that we can't use your actual sale price, and we're going to have to come up with this deemed price that we're looking at, the reasonable price, what we do is we've created a concept called a first destination market. And you recall when I was saying some of our overarching principles were, oh my gosh, there's all these pipelines down in the lower 48, and you could end up with your gas being down in Omaha or Tallahassee, and there's an actual price down there, and if we say destination market down there in Tallahassee, we're going to have to figure out what the pipeline costs were to get it there and probably back it up, and there was an intermediate sale, and there might be five pipelines in between here and there. And so what we're trying to do instead is pick the first place where this gas went that had a very liquid market, and that means that there's lots of transactions, a lot of third-party arm's-length transactions. It's an active market that's abuzz with gas sales. So it's vibrant, it's robust, and there's a reason if somebody didn't sell their gas there, then they probably figured they could get more for it elsewhere. So they've moved on and sold it somewhere else. But we're comfortable that we know how to figure out what the price is at that place, at that liquid market. And it's generally a liquid market's going to have posted prices. And so it's a place of certainty. It's a place that everybody can figure out what the price of the gas is at that liquid market.
And Marcia, if the gas goes to Alberta, they've got the AECO market.
Correct.
But if it goes to Valdez, what's the market there?
Well, if it goes to Valdez, then presuming we're talking about an LNG, and that's our second bullet. Yes, thank you. We're going to look at the daily volume of LNG or regasified LNG that is sold in arm's length transactions. So basically, we'll look at arm's length sales. We actually have a body of law that's developed around LNG valuation associated with the Nikiski plant. So we're pretty comfortable that we've figured out how to value LNG product for purposes of tax. And finally, if there's gas plant products, these are things that come out. We generally are going to look at a place where both the residue gas and the gas plant products are being pulled out. We don't want to end up in some obscure place where all they do is pull out butanes for some unique process, because it's just not going to have a lot of third-party action. So again, our goal is to look for some place where there's a lot of activity, where we can have some confidence that the marketplace is functioning really well, and that the market price that's being placed on these products is a good solid one that hasn't been manipulated either because of a lack of supply, a lack of demand, or parties knowing each other. So when we look at what the prevailing value is going to be for gas that is delivered to the marketplace in Canada or the lower 48, we look at the package of products that are in that gas stream. And so what we do is if that gas went down as the residue gas plus all the gas products in it, and the gas products got stripped out and they got sold separately, we'll add up all the pieces that got sold to come up with what that product value is.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
And are each of these ores the higher of? Are we back to the higher of, or is this something that's fielder's choice
in the hands of the
commissioner?
It would depend upon what the fact circumstances. These would be based on the fact. If you've got components being sold, then you'd use that component factor. If you've just simply got them sold into non-product, but basically just all in one piece, you're going to be looking at weighted average. I'll back up a second. I think those are by sequence. If it's available, if you've got that information available in the first bullet point, that's what you're using. If you don't have them broken out and have those separate amounts, you're using weighted. Go ahead.
Okay. The higher of is the higher of between an individual taxpayer's arm's length transactions and the prevailing value. Mm-hmm. So that's their higher of. What this is telling you...
Now we've fallen into the prevailing value sort of basket.
Yeah. In order to compare those two, for an individual taxpayer, we have to determine what the prevailing value is that we're going to establish at a particular location. This is showing you kind of the hierarchy, as Marcia said, to establish that leg of the comparison. And so we first look at those public prices. If we can't find those, then we get a weighted average of all the sales that we can collect to establish a prevailing value, not just an individual taxpayers, but all of them. And if that's not available, then we'll go to finding where we can get government prices.
But ultimately, if I may, Mr. Chairman, ultimately this is going to come down at some level to a value judgment by somebody as to which of these applies, in whose authority does that decision rest?
Senator French, through the chair. No, I mean, essentially what we're doing is we have charged ourselves with the obligation of locating published prices and of publishing those prices to make them available, and we've set criteria for what kinds of published prices we can use and will use. If we are unable to find published prices to achieve objective in the first bullet point, then by default, we will then have to drop down to the weighted average sale price, and again, it will be our obligation to report what that number is so that taxpayers know what the weighted average sale of third-party transactions is. And again, it needs to be in a place where there's a lot of third-party sales that we can pick up the facts about what those sales are. And they generally are published, say, for instance, in ACO. There's a whole publication of all the sales that take place and what the pricing is. They track that data in Canada. The Canadian government does.
And maybe to more directly answer your question, it's all under the authority of the commissioner implementing the statutory requirements, but the sort of selection, as it were, is guided by the regulations with established fairly specific criteria upon which a determination will be made as to whether to use this first one, whether you've met that requirement. It's got fairly straightforward requirements to be considered liquid, and you'll see as we go through that it's not discretionary to a large extent. It's based upon criteria that is fairly well established.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
For greater detail, in terms of what we're talking about having to publish by February 1st of each year, we would be obligating ourselves to tell our taxpayers where what we have determined qualifies as first destination markets. That means we will have determined that it had sufficient volume, that it had sufficient arm's length transactions, and that there was publication that we would be able to put out for public consumption. We would also list what the name of the publication or source of our published price was so that they would be able to track it as well and anticipate it and be able to keep their records clearly. Also, in terms of once you pick the destination market, if there is clearly a location or quality differential that would apply because something is being sold elsewhere but you need to shift the location, we would be acknowledging what those are, as well as quality differentials. And finally, reasonable gas treatment, processing, or regasification cost allowances, if applicable. Again, when we get into the idea that someone is marketing their gas plant products, which means they've gone through all that cost to treat the gas or process the gas, and if it's LNG, the cost to regasify, et cetera, there are cost allowances for that. So we would be publishing what those are, because those are essentially set on a third-party arm's length kind of average, weighted average figure. So again, we're trying to give some bright line numbers out there so people can use them and not wonder what it's going to be. One of the things that a lot of people get confused about, and it's easy to, because we have spent this generation's life has been spent thinking oil, North Slope, and to the point that on the North Slope, when gas gets produced out of Prudhoe, and it gets processed through the central gas facility, and liquids are stripped out that are called natural gas liquids. And those natural gas liquids owe their source to both oil and gas down in the reservoir, per se. But what we've done statutorily is we've said those are oil, and they'll be taxed as oil. And you know, because that's our world. We didn't have any gas really being sold. So the plant up there that does that, it's a central gas facility, has two parts to it, conceivable parts. One part, the primary part that we know and love, is the gas processing plant, and that's the one that strips out the propane and strips out the natural gas liquids, etc. And that is upstream of the point of production, gets deducted as a lease expenditure cost and qualifies for capital credits, etc. What's left in that gas is it either gets diverted and sent back downhole or is available to be sent over to a pipeline. And so when you think about it, the gas processing plant that is located upstream of the gas treatment upstream makes NGLs and it's deductible. But in the gas world, there are terms of art in the gas world that conflict with our world. And one of the things we had to bump up against when we started talking to experts is they use terms NGLs. And we thought, oh, well, we know what that is. No, we didn't know what that was. Because in the gas world, natural gas liquids, in their mind, is everything that you can strip out of the gas, you know, the propane, the butane, the NGLs, all these other things that you can strip out and leave just the methane, the residue gas. And so we had to start telling them how to use different words because we were getting confused. The other thing is because they can do that downstream, there are, technically speaking, gas processing plants that can be located downstream. So if somebody is selling their Prudhoe gas, which might be rich in propanes and butanes and everything, it conceivably can go to a plant down in Alberta or Kenai or Wasilla or someplace, and these components of the gas can be stripped out, and it would be stripped out in a plant that would also be considered a gas processing plant. It's not a gas treatment plant because it's not being done simply to make it transportable. It's gas processing. And the gas industry generally calls these NGLs. And so I just want to point that out, that as you start to hear people talk about the new gas world, we had to define a thing called a downstream gas plant because it wasn't dealt with in our prior statutes. And what that is it's essentially a gas processing plant that's downstream of the point of production. And it, too, can extract NGLs. So,
Okay, maybe you could just clarify this. I don't know if I'm the only one missing this, but could you have a gas processing plant anywhere other than on the North Slope? I thought I heard you say yes.
Absolutely.
Well, wait. Under the defined
term. Oh, I'm sorry, a defined term. Yeah, okay. The defined term, if I put quotes around gas processing plant, that is the term of art that is defined in Alaska Statute 4355-900, and it is juxtaposed with gas treatment plant in the statute, okay? So the reason it was important to define those two terms was for purposes of administering the production tax, we had to decide what part of the gas handling costs on the North Slope were going to be considered upstream of the point of production, and what part of the costs were going to be determined to be downstream of the point of production. And that's why there are two definitions, gas processing plant to pick up things that are upstream, and gas treatment plant, which are things downstream of the point of production. But that was from our focus thinking of the world as being the North Slope. Now, what's happened is there can be the processing of gas that occurs off of the North Slope. And we had to come up with a word for that, because in the gas world, a gas treatment plant is a meaningful term, and such that there are, the FERC regulates tariffs associated with gas treatment plants. But gas processing is not necessarily or regulated, and it's more of a manufacturing process that happens, you know, when gas flows through and it's got valuable components in it. So we couldn't call it a gas processing plant because that's a defined term that's defined to be a specific type of plant that's located upstream of our point of production for a tax. And so we're now calling the thing that happens that involves gas processing when it's not on the North Slope, when it's downstream, we call it a downstream gas plant. So this is one of the challenges that we've encountered as we work through our regulation, is developing terminology that helps us keep our concepts clear and straight and not be too juxtaposed with normal lingo that the gas manufacturing people use. One of the things that we came up with that we sort of beat our consultants into was we just hated to hear them call all the stuff that they strip out of the gas down the lower 48 NGLs, because we are so bred to think of NGLs as that product stream that we call oil that comes off the North Slope. It was driving us crazy. So we made them come up with a term called gas plant products. So in our regulations, when you see the term gas plant products, what we're trying to do is define all the stuff that can get stripped out, including NGLs, but to distinguish those things from what remains when you strip everything out, which is essentially a methane stream or the residue gas. And again, I think we just repeated what we did with the gas treatment plant. And again, that's, oh, actually, you know what's interesting? Well, maybe it's not that interesting.
Oh, no, this
is fascinating. You're revealing too much of
me. I know. Actually, our statutes technically define gas treatment, but they never defined a gas treatment plant. So we felt, you know, the nerds of us felt that lack. And so we have put in that definitional term also. So now we've got all the types of plants you can imagine defined.
You're French.
Maybe this would help to sort of bring to our attention, you know, so where the issues are in this. You've just promulgated these regulations. You're throwing them open for public comment. The comments are going to come from industry folks who understand this, you know, to the same degree that you do. Where do you expect to get pushback? Where do you think, where are the areas of conflict, if you will, or disagreement with respect to what we're putting out and what the industry hopes to get from these regs?
Well, I have to be careful in commenting, because obviously it's out for comment, and any comments we get, we will be providing, you know, written responses back, because we're in this formal 30-day period. But we did have a workshop on this portion of the regs, and at that workshop, the hearing, that's right, it wasn't a workshop hearing. One producer commented, a lot of the questions were just more trying to understand and make sure they understood what the regulations were saying, and they were clearly going to go back and do more formal writing, written up comments. But based on the questions that we were getting, it was more along the lines of trying to understand what prevailing value was, how in their world, where they go and sell gas, what will it mean to them in terms of which price do they use to calculate their tax on. So again, they were trying to understand the concept of this first destination market. They also were unclear why we were referring to the prior year's cost data. And, you know, we'll be able to explain that we're actually doing that for their benefit so they have a reasonable chance of having access to the data. Those were the comments. I understand we're supposed to be getting something in writing from AOGA soon that'll give us a clearer picture of sort of what their concerns are with the way these are structured. But those, that's our preliminary indication. Okay. I think this just restates what we've been describing. There is an allowance for a processing cost associated with a downstream gas plant. Now that we all know what a downstream gas plant is, recall that's the processing that you can do downstream. And clearly, if we're going to ask somebody to pay their tax based on the value of a product that comes out of a plant, they need to have the right to deduct what the cost was to process it and get it to that point where it was marketable as that product. So we have to come up with the deductibility of the processing costs. We have complexities associated with somebody having multiple gas processing contracts. Again, this is that idea of trying to be fair and prorate so that we don't say, aha, the state's gas is the one that got that really juicy contract. So again, we're going to be doing prorating and allocating. And the same holds true for the allocation of costs for processing commingled streams, because recall in Alaska, there will someday be gas that comes through our gas transportation system that is not taxed. That will be coming from federal offshore leases. And so again, you know, there shouldn't be any cherry picking by us or industry. We'll allocate the cost fairly and evenly across all the streams. So now we come to transportation deductions. This set of regulations is the one that's actually industry has had a longer time to react to many of the provisions that are here, because we began our process with, we've probably had four workshops on transportation deductions as they applied to oil costs. And as a result of those workshops, we went through a lot of changes in our structure, so that by the time we realized that, oh my gosh, we've got to get a gas pipeline transportation costs fleshed out as well, we were able to fold that in with all the body of work we had done up to that point in time for the oil transportation costs. The statutory direction to the department is that the gross value, again, remember that taxpayer sitting there trying to figure out what to deduct by way of transportation costs. Our statutory direction is we use the actual cost of transportation or the reasonable cost of transportation, whichever is lower. And in addition, when the modifications that ACES made to the production tax took place, this body directed us to give more credence, make prima facie reasonable any of the costs that were certified as just and reasonable by the FERC or the RCA. So unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, actual costs are not necessarily reasonable costs. And so when what we do is we look at reasonable costs will be different than actual costs when we have affiliated transactions. And recall that was the 10% threshold for voting interest, non-arm's length, or a transportation methodology that is not reasonable in view of existing market alternatives. And these are the three criteria that are set out for us in statute.
Can I ask you a question, mm-hmm. Marcia? These regs, do they these only apply to the gas pipeline?
No. Senator Wilkowski, our regulations apply to both oil transportation, gas treatment plants, LNG plants, LNG regasification, and vessel costs for LNG vessels or oil tankers. All modes of transportation types of costs have a provision in here that tells you how to arrive at what the reasonable cost would be if we can't rely upon the actual cost.
And the regs in general that we're looking at apply to both oil and gas transportation?
Yes. With some exception, there are some unique aspects to gas.
And just for clarity, I assume it would apply both to an Aegea gas line versus a non-Aegea gas line.
That's correct.
Just to put it in context, most of what the regs cover is almost exclusively dealing with gas. Only with regard to the transportation deduction portion did we kind of hold that one back with regard to the oil regulations to make sure that we didn't get out ahead of ourselves with regard to the transportation deduction, so that we can make sure that we married the oil transportation deduction with what we came up with on the gas side. And so that's the one component of this package that we're talking about that really has application to oil. The rest is almost exclusively on gas.
And then just to follow up, would these regulations apply as well to, say, a bullet line from the North Slope or a spur line?
Yes. We have some in-state provisions.
Pat, do you agree with that statement, Pat? Let's say we did.
It gets a little complicated because when we talk about, if you remember, we prefaced a lot of the valuation stuff that says gas that is sold outside of Alaska. And we don't need to really get into it too much, but some of the valuation stuff is going to be different mm-hmm. when you're talking about Alaska markets. We didn't get into prevailing values and published prices and that sort of thing for the Alaska markets. So I just don't want to mislead the scope of application to an in-state line. But as far as transportation deduction and so forth, that would be relevant to an in-state line as well.
And it is addressed. I mean, we actually have some transportation regs already on the books. And so to the extent that we needed to modify them to take into account the unique aspects of transport of gas outside the state, et cetera, some of those will clearly on their face be limited to when gas is marketed outside the state.
Thank you.
So when we ask ourselves what are reasonable costs, what are the choices? The first choice are rates that are adjudicated as just and reasonable by the RCA or other regulatory body, and this is as directed by the legislature in ACES. Second category that we've added, and what, because we learned that gas tariffs don't get the same degree of what I'll call scrubbing down that our TAPS tariffs seem to get, they do lots of them. I understand FERC does lots of gas tariff, you know, reviews, but they've sort of got a more abbreviated methodology for when a tariff comes in. They do a sort of a scrubbing down and looking at it, but they don't do this formal adjudicate them as just and reasonable. So instead, they do an approval process. And what we have determined here is we will honor, in the spirit of what the legislature gave us as directions for the prima facie direction for just and reasonable adjudication, we will honor initial gas tariff rates that are approved by the FERC. Those are the first ones that come out of the hat. They're the ones that get filed when someone is seeking their issuance of their certificate of public convenience and necessity from FERC. And so it has a high degree of review. It just isn't technically just and reasonable adjudication. But we want to honor that as well. In addition, pipeline and gas treatment plant tariffs that are under settlement agreements. And this is something that we evolved during our oil transportation deduction thought process and trying to understand. And it frankly didn't make much sense to the Department of Revenue that if the state entered into a settlement and said, okay, you know, this is a good tariff and we want to sign on the dotted line and accept this tariff, that we shouldn't at least give it that same prima facie nod that this should be considered reasonable. Now, one of the things we've done to both 1, 2, and 3 is acknowledge that each of these, what I'll call sanctionings of a tariff rate as being reasonable, is limited in time in terms of its reasonableness. It can get stale. For instance, you can have a TAPS rate that's adjudicated as just and reasonable, and generally that's a very cumbersome process. And in order for someone to make the case that it should be supported, they'll gather their test data about what their costs were and what the shipping costs and their rates of return and everything. And it's called the test data. And it usually is about 2 years before that test data gets sanctified by FERC as being just and reasonable. So by the time that happens, you're 2 years old. And so what we said, we're going to give it at least another 3 years. So we'll give it... We'll give whatever data you put in front of the FERC 5 years to be valid. And at that point, then we start to look at something else. The same with the initial gas tariff rates. We basically said those are good for at least 3 years because, again, that's going to be current test data since it hasn't started yet.
Marshall, and, did you say number three, settlement agreements, that was prima facie evidence of a reason?
We're putting it in the same category. It's not directed by the legislature to do so, but what we're doing is we're basically saying we're going to stack up settlement agreements in the same place as adjudicated, just and reasonable, et cetera. But there's going to be conditions on that. One, it needs to be a settlement agreement that the state's a party to. Two, it needs to be a cost-based structured settlement. In other words, what I've learned is they have settlements called black box settlements, which sound mysterious to me as a lawyer. I've never experienced a black box settlement, but a cost-based settlement is one that on its face is very similar to what FERC would administer. It has, you look at the costs and you allow them to be depreciated and you allow, you know, rate of return on capital, et cetera. And so it's a very, what I'll call, normal structured settlement. And in addition, in order for it to be evergreen, in other words, if we were going to just let it ride, there needs to be a reopener for the state, that at least every 2 years the state has the option to kick out of it if it's become stale or anachronistic at that point.
I think that's an excellent provision, because didn't we get stuck with a really bad settlement agreement years ago that cost us billions?
Well, yeah, we have learned, like I said, we've had an opportunity to learn from our experiences in terms of the oil world. So what we're trying to do is be fair and balanced. And so in doing this, we wanted to have a policy that encouraged settlement. Litigation is not generally eats up everybody's dollars. And so if we had something that encouraged settlement, we thought that was a positive. But at the same time, they needed to be settlements that we could, you know, that we could live with those terms for a period of time. And finally, if none of those three categories is available because they just don't exist, the facts don't involve them, there is what I'll call the default method, or there's this methodology that we have developed in our regulations that will establish the, quote, reasonable cost of service if it is not an arm's length or third-party transaction. And the next slides are going to go into what that is. It's called a cost of service methodology. And it's in section, it's our proposed regulation 15 AAC 55.197. And it basically is modeled after the FERC and the RCA methodologies. It's pretty standard, plain vanilla. You have operating and maintenance expenses that are allowed to be recovered. You have the economic life of the pipe. You know, you decide that it's 25 years or the greater of the useful life. For their accounting, you depreciate all the capital, but it only gets depreciated once. So if somebody sells it, they can't restart the clock and begin to depreciate it all over again. You allow income tax deductions, and you allow a return on their undepreciated capital. That's always a sexy topic. What's the return on capital? And what we've done is we've essentially tried to look again at the experts FERC and see how they've done it. And we use a similar rate of return that they use, and it involves getting a proxy group, and it's a methodology that's pretty well hammered out there. And to the extent there's no FERC involved, and I think what we're talking about is the unregulated, like the gas treatment plant or something else, we've selected Moody's all industrial users, which is a B, a capital B, little a rating. And what I'm going to do is, Fred, are you on the phone? I'll have to get him unmuted.
Fred, are you on the phone? Mr. Hagemeyer?
Yes. Do you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Fred, I'm up to example one. And what we have are two examples. One is a simple one of just simply North Slope Gas being delivered to Alberta. And then the other one shows a more typical example where gas may be delivered to two places, Alberta and Chicago. And we thought that walking through this example with Fred would sort of illuminate the pieces that we've just gone through in terms of the global structure. So, Fred, would you like to start to discuss example one?
Fred, if you could put yourself on the record and please go ahead on example one.
Okay, yes, this is Fred Hagemeyer, and be happy to walk through example one on slide 21, if you have that in front of you. This is intended to sort of encapsulate many of the things that Marsh has been walking through in terms of the pieces and parts, but in a very simple way. So there are a number of complexities that aren't here, and it would probably not be worthwhile before we get this structure understood by folks. But generally speaking, what this is trying to walk through is just starting with production, and the numbers are small here in terms of production. But we're talking about, in this case, producing, as you can see on the left-hand side of the slide going down, a number that's only 91 MCF. And since on the BTU value, that will be converted, and it will be around 100 million BTU. So going through the various value chains that will go down through here, it will be tracked mostly in MMBTU after it leaves the lease or the point of production. As you can see, it will go down through the gas treatment plant in this example, move down through transportation facilities, which can be more than one. And in this case, the destination is going to Alberta, where it would go through a processing facility, and then it would you would determine a value, whether it be through the processes that were described by Marcia in terms of an actual value, or in a case perhaps where it's prevailing value based upon the indicators that you would have. And it turns out that in Alberta, we have a fairly liquid market, particularly for AECO, for residue gas, and for gas plant products at Edmonton. So as you can see the direction going down as we're going down to the pipeline to Alberta and the various pieces. So the way this is set up then, we're going to start at the bottom on the right side at destination value. So in this particular example, if you look over to the right of the yellow box or destination value, you'll see that we have gone through processing at this time, and we really have more than two, but we're going to use two for purposes of the example, and that would be residue gas measured in MMBTU. In this case, it has a volume of 90. Now, that would be the amount of residue gas that you have left over after processing from 100 MMBTU. In this example, and again, just to point out, it is a simplified example, we are not showing the line loss that you normally would see at the various stages of the transportation or treatment would use the fuel, or use the gas as fuel in their activity. But this one does not show that, and that's sort of noted on the bottom. So we have residue gas of 90 MMBTU, and then what was extracted out is the gas plant product, which will have the components of ethane and propane and butane and pentanes. Those collectively have a volume of 200 gallons. And then you can see a price. These prices are just indicative for illustration purposes. But $6 per MMBTU for the residue gas is what it would be sold at, or would be the prevailing value in this case, could be the AECO market. And then you see it translates over to an absolute dollar value using the $6 per MMBTU, and in this case, 50 cents for the gallons. And so then at that point you have a destination value of $640 total, and you would move back up and you have a number of allowances in terms of deductions. One of them would be the processing cost that you have gone through in the Alberta market. In this case, you had an inlet volume of 100 MMBTU here in this example, And I remember that as that got extracted out, it ended up with 90 MMBTU of residue gas, and then you had the gas plant products, which are measured in gallons at that point. And then as you look, they usually, in the case of a gas processing facility, there can be a number of ways that you contract with them, but it would be converted to a dollars per MMBTU in terms of, or can be converted into dollars per MMBTU for a cost factor. In this case, it's 20 cents, so that's a reduction off. As you move back up, you also have an allowance for transportation, which is usually a pretty significant portion. In this example, we had the 100 MMBTU for volume coming down the Alaska pipeline for both the Alaska and the Canadian segment, and we're using a dollar MMBTU cost of $3 in this example, and also in the Alberta system, which once you would get off the Alaska main line and you entered into the Alberta system, it's in this case we're using 10 cents as the cost rate, which would get you to the processing plant or the AECO markets. And then as you move back up, you have the gas treatment plant expenses. Again, we're using the total volume in this case of the 100 MMBTU, in this case a $1 rate for a throughput rate on that GTP. And as you subtract those elements, you end up with a total value to point of production of $2,210.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. How about example two, Fred?
We'll move to example two on page 22. It's very much the same, except in this example, we are coming down the Alaska main line, and at a point just north of the Alberta market, part of the gas, in this case, half of the gas volume, is going down the Alliance pipeline system to Chicago. So this example presumes that there's an interconnection of Alliance into the Alaska main line at some point before it enters the Alberta system. And so as you can see, as you come down the left-hand side, again, the same volumes of 91 MCF, which converts to 100 MMBTU, you're going through the GTP. It comes down the Alaska main line, both the Alaska and Canadian segment. It splits off into Alberta market into Chicago market. So those become the two destination markets. So as you heard earlier about identifying a destination market, in these examples, they would be identified as being liquid destination markets in both cases, and both would have residue gas prices and can have gas plant products prices to utilize also. So going over to the right-hand side of the example, you see at the very bottom, this would be the Chicago market. And in this case, half the volume after it's processed and residue gas is 45 MMBTU. And then corresponding, there's 100 gallons of gas plant products, which has a value of 60 cents on average across all those products, equaling $60. 45 MMBTU is times $6.75 per MMBTU, and that has a value of $303. So you have a total value of $363 then at that destination. Same process, just above it in the yellow, is in Alberta, and again, it has a $6 price at AECO against a 45 MMBTU, and 100 gallons of gas plant products have been extracted into constituent parts, or has an average of 50 cents, in this case, per gallon, and those are added up over here, so you have 320. So those two combined, then, now we have a deduction, in this case, for both Alberta and Chicago in processing, of 20 cents in Alberta, as we had before in the earlier example, 25 cents this example is using in Chicago. And then as we move up the example, you also see we have the Alaska pipeline, the Alaskan Canadian section, still at $3 for the total volume of 100. And again, we don't have fuel line loss shown in this, which would be very typical. So the volume numbers would change in a more detailed example. And the Alberta system has a 10 cents that we showed before for half the volumes at that point. The Alliance pipeline, we show a $1 cost per MMBTU. And then when you subtract out those deductions, you end up, and I'm sorry, you also have the whole 100 MMBTU times the $1 GTP cost. And eventually you end up with $2.06. In this case, having split your volumes and going to two different destination markets, you come back with $2.06 for that month at the value of point of production.
Fred, Can I just get a point of clarity on the Alliance Pipeline? Is that a pipeline that runs from Alberta to Chicago?
Essentially, yes. It originates in Alberta and in actually truncates in Chicago, the area west of Chicago, into a very large gas plant facility called Aux Sable.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to turn it over to Marcia. Questions? Okay, seeing none. Pat.
I just want to make sure we're clear on the record here because, hey, Fred, this is Pat. When I look at this, one of the questions that this is raising, I'm sorry to do this in front of everybody, but I look at the destination value in Chicago, and it appears to me that you're basically getting a $43.75 uplift by going to Chicago in terms of your actual destination value. But when you deduct the differential cost to get to Chicago from Alberta, it appears to be about $47.50 or something like that. And my question that raises is, given what we described earlier about there'd be a prevailing value, first destination value, in this particular instance, if the destination value in Chicago turned out to be less than the destination value in Alberta, would there be a use of the Alberta price, or would they be able to get the lower ultimate wellhead or point of production value by going to Chicago?
In this example, and I guess the way it works, the way the regs are laid out, is that if Chicago is determined to be a destination value, then it's felt to be a liquid market for all the considerations that we've talked about. And in this case, then the fact that there happens to be in this particular month the price in Chicago may be slightly less than the marginal transportation to get there coming from the end of the Alaska mainline just happens to be the situation that month. Mm-hmm. But it would not, I don't believe, change the process whereby you would look at Chicago because it's been determined to be a destination value at that point. And you would utilize that, assuming that the residue gas price is a price that is utilized in the destination value determination.
But then at the point where the gas basically diverts some to Alberta, some to Chicago, there would be a proration of that. You know, if we've got a situation where there's other gas besides Alaska gas, they would have to prorate how much is considered to have gone to Chicago, how much is considered to have gone to Alberta?
That's correct. This example does not go into the fact that very possibly, though, the particular shipper will have other gas associated with this, so the contract that they may be selling to in Chicago, for example, could have a number of other gases, so there is an allocation factor of the gas that would be associated with the North Slope gas with this. In this particular example, we didn't complicate it with that allocation, but it would be allocated if it existed.
Thanks, Fred.
Okay, thank you, Fred. Any questions for Mr. Hagemeyer? Okay, seeing none, please proceed. We've got about 10, 15 more minutes. I don't know that we're going to get through this today. We've got you scheduled for tomorrow, so we can bring you back tomorrow. But please go ahead and let's get as far as we can.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chair, we're moving now into the section dealing specifically with the AGIA inducement parts of the regs. And just to clarify the record, because we talked about the dates and the comment dates available for these, if I can just make it perfectly clear on the record, the package that we're referring to here is the ACES regulations dealing with valuation and transportation that we just did. They went out for notice on February 9th. There was a public hearing on March 3rd, and the comment period closes on March 15th. The section that we're dealing with now, that I'm moving into with regard to the AGIA regulations, was noticed on February 19th. The public hearing was yesterday, as Marcia indicated. and the comments are due on those by March 22nd. So the first
people are scurrying around. We're watching gavel to gavel to get there.
Get ready to comment. they're ready. It's important to us.
This is critically important. I mean, the devil is in the details, and this is critically, critically important for the state. And I know you've put a huge amount of time into it, and I want to thank you for the time you've put into it. I know people may disagree with some of the things in here, but I know you've certainly worked hard to try to protect Alaska, so thank you.
Thanks. So in order to understand the qualification for the AGIA inducements, and this is going to be the same qualification requirements for both the royalty inducements and the tax inducements. In fact, the qualification requirements are basically shared between the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of Natural Resources, and so all of the requirements and the application and so forth is done jointly. We have, in order to sort of handle this in the regulatory process, because we have two different inducements, one in the royalty section of the regulations, one in the tax section, we actually have two identical descriptions of how you qualify in the two different sections of the regs. And so what I'm describing here is the sections within the tax inducement portion, which should be identical at the end of the day with the ones to qualify for the royalty ones. The sequence of events, as you recall, the inducement is available to shippers who commit to acquire firm capacity in the initial open season of the AGIA pipeline. And you'll see in here a distinction made between shippers who are producers, and we also have to make provisions for the potential situation where we have a shipper who acquires capacity who isn't a producer, who's actually buying gas up on the slope at the wellhead and then shipping it on capacity that they picked up. In those instances, they are able to acquire a voucher for this inducement and then ostensibly pass that on to the shipper for their tax and royalty benefit, and then presumably get some compensation for that, for providing that to the producer when they make their purchase of the gas. In order to identify what shippers qualify for this inducement, in order to say you have committed to acquire firm capacity, we had to look at the transaction that's taking place between the pipe company and the shipper in order to determine who's ultimately going to qualify for this inducement. And so we had to define a couple terms. And the first one is what's referred to as a precedent agreement. And this is the agreement that will emerge from the initial open season transaction between the shipper and the pipeline company. So if you submit a bid and there is then a negotiation and an agreement as to the terms of that bid, it will be memorialized in the form of a precedent agreement that is then submitted to FERC and so forth. The precedent agreement, as it says here, establishes the general terms of transportation service that the shipper will be obligated to acquire if they ultimately reach what is the actual agreement to transport the gas, which is referred to as a transportation services agreement. That agreement, the TSA, isn't going to be reached until you get down to sanctioning decisions on the pipeline. You have to get your FERC certificate, you have to get your financing, you have to get other things lined up, and then you will enter into the transportation services agreement. but...
French has a question.
Yes.
Just as a matter of sort of introduction to these terms, are these fairly standard industry terms? I mean, are these, I mean, we're not inventing this. This is a matter, this is commercial practices that happen all across North America and the rest of the world as gas pipelines are put into effect.
That is correct. These are not unique to Alaska or to AGEA at all. And in fact, when I say define, this is more just describing the typical practice as opposed to defining for unique purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The precedent agreement will also identify the conditions that have to be met in order for the shipper to then be obligated to enter into a transportation services agreement. As part of the open season process, the pipeline will set out sort of what they are offering as part of the precedent agreement. They will identify those things that they are expecting the shipper to agree to and the conditions upon which that they could place, and then they're opening it up to additional conditions that could be placed during the open season. Those would have to be negotiated after the open season to result in a precedent agreement that actually identifies if these things are met, then you will go to a transportation service agreement. And as it says here, the transportation services agreement is then the unconditional obligation to pay the firm transportation costs. And the sequence that we have to qualify for the AGEA inducements is you have to apply and you have to demonstrate that you have met the qualification requirements, and then you separately are then eligible for the royalty inducement, which has certain additional requirements in terms of you have to agree to change your leases and other things that are unique to the royalty inducement. And you also separately have the tax inducement available to you through the regulations that we'll describe here shortly. So as I mentioned earlier, to be considered to qualify, you have to commit to acquire firm transportation capacity in the first binding open season. So the regs say that in order to be considered to have committed to acquire firm transportation capacity in the binding open season means that you have to do each of these. You have to submit a bid for firm transportation capacity during the initial open season. You have to execute a precedent agreement within 180 days after the close of the initial open season. You have to ultimately execute a transportation services agreement within 5 years of the open season or 2 years following FERC certification, whichever is later. Those dates align with the sanctioning requirements of the AGEA statute. And you have to file your paperwork and copies of the documents and demonstrate that you've actually done these things and submit those to the two commissioners.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator French.
You've given us a lot to chew on. Let me just pose a real simple hypothetical so I can understand, or maybe folks watching can understand, how this might play out. Open season happens on the 1st of May. A company will, just for the purposes of the argument, call them Exxon. Exxon says we want we want 1.5 BCF a day in the pipeline, and we submit a bid. They execute a precedent agreement, and this is between Exxon and TransCanada, or the
Exxon and the pipeline, and the Alaska
pipeline
project
subsidiary, correct? And in that, they say the precedent agreement says, look, we're going to give you 1.5 a day, but the only condition we want is we want a 5 cents an MCF tax. And if we can get that 5 cents MCF tax, then we're going to give you a beat half a day. Let's just say they do that. So they've executed a precedent agreement because there's conditions in there. Is that the kind of condition you mean, or is it a separate condition?
there could be a whole
There'll probably be 20 conditions.
Suite of conditions, right, that could deal most directly with what has to be done with the pipeline project in order for the shipper to then be obligated to actually move to a TSA. But there also could be, as you mentioned, conditions that are external to the relationship between the two. But they would have to be conditions that basically the pipeline company is willing to have as conditions in their precedent agreement. In other words, they are going to continue to advance this project with the expectation that ultimately it would lead to a sanctioning go forward. And so the specificity of the condition is going to have to meet their level of acceptance in order to actually embed it into this precedent agreement.
So, I mean, just if I could, TransCanada could conceivably say, that's outlandish, that's never going to happen, we reject that, that's not even a bid we're going to accept.
Correct.
Okay, okay. But assuming that there's like 10 commercial conditions in one sort of external one, they could agree to go forward with that external condition embedded in their precedent agreement and hope that it somehow gets resolved in time for them to execute a transportation services agreement.
Correct. The just one thing that I'll also note is that a big part of what's happening in the negotiation of the precedent agreement is also who is ultimately responsible for the development costs of getting from that point in the process to the next big flag, the sanctioning movement to a transportation services agreement. And if the project ends up not going forward at that ultimate point, who's going to pay for those things? And so the conditions are on there as much to provide clarity for that part of the relationship as well, is who's picking up the tab, who's taking the risks associated with continuing the spend on the project as it moves forward.
It's a fairly, I mean, I'm just going to guess, it's a fairly complex commercial, you know, contracting negotiation between two sophisticated parties.
That's putting it lightly.
Right. Thank you. Somebody's going to make a bunch of money just drawing up the documents.
At it's 5 o'clock. Yes. I just want to ask you one last question. Could you turn to slide 25, please?
Backwards,
and
backwards.
You define precedent agreement. I don't know if this is how you define it specifically in the regs or not, but you say establishes general terms of transportation service under which shipper will be obligated to acquire firm transportation capacity. Do you have some sort of definition of general terms? And let me ask you where I'm going. Let me tell you where I'm going with this. Sort of bootstrap on Senator French's question, let's say producer comes in and says, okay, we'll agree to put our B and a half in the pipeline, assuming that we can get fiscal certainty from the state or fiscal terms that are satisfactory to us. Does that satisfy the general term requirement of precedent agreement? Do you define that somewhere in the reg?
Mr. Chair, first off, I think the language here is not taken directly from the proposed regs, but and that sentence is intended to capture not the conditions like the one that you just described in terms of what they might throw on their offer as a condition before they would advance to a transportation service agreement. The general terms of transportation services is intended to represent the actual tariff terms, the general methodology for determining what the tariff's going to be, you know, how the costs are going to be recovered. Are they going to be recovered over X number of years? If they're, and I'll just give you an example from the current debate. I mean, going to the complexity, just the open season plan that was submitted by the Alaska Pipeline Project generated, I think, 72 pages of comments from BP on the tariff terms being offered And the one of the issues that they raised was in the winter, pipeline capacity increases because of the temperature. And the
I see we're going down a rabbit.
No, I'm just I
know committee members have other appointments, and I want to try to get everyone out of here. But just so if I'm hearing you correctly, that could, if someone said we'll agree to put gas in the pipeline as long as we get fiscal certainty or some terms like that, would they be able to get a precedent agreement under the regulations?
Potentially, if their condition is specified in a way that is acceptable to the Alaska Pipeline Project for the purposes of their relationship, and if they're willing to go forward on a go-forward basis with the project on the basis of that particular condition, and it is sufficient for them to feel like the development costs and everything else is properly and the risks of going forward are properly allocated between the parties based on that condition.
We've gone a few minutes late. We still have a little ways to go. We do have this scheduled again for tomorrow and again next week as well for the DNR regs. Any final questions from committee members? Seeing none. Okay, I appreciate you coming in. And
we'll pick this up tomorrow.
We'll pick this up tomorrow, and with that, we're adjourned.